My task this afternoon is to talk about missional church, a church on mission, but in fact, not so much about foreign missions, about going somewhere else, but rather being a church that is on mission within your own community, your own city, your own town, your own village, whatever circumstance you find yourself in. A leading missiologist by the name of Wilbert Schenck, a number of years ago said this: to do mission in the West, we must become strangers in our own societies again. Curious idea. We must become strangers in our own societies again. That is, we must begin to look at our societies with new eyes, as if we were aliens to the culture. In fact, a lot of times when we look for church planters for urban center situations, the best profile for us to start with is somebody who has been raised in the culture and then leaves the culture for a while, either to do education, to do business some other place, and then they come back to their culture. And when they come back to their culture, usually what they do is they see it differently than what they did before. They see the good things and they see the bad things. They're more critically evaluating their own culture. This was essentially what happened to Leslie Newbegin. I don't know how many of you know of the British missionary Leslie Newbegin. He was a missionary to India. He comes back to the UK, to England, in the early 60s, late 50s. And when he came back, he was startled by what he saw. And he began to realize that actually, in order to do ministry back in England, he had to go through the same contextualization process that he had to do in India. Because he realized that the UK, that England, was no longer a Christian nation, if it ever was. He saw it with fresh eyes, with a new approach. And in one sense, it's in the seeds of Newbegin's thought that this whole term missional comes to begin to be used. He was the one that really kind of began to get people to think about their culture, and in particularly about Europe. It wasn't really until the 60s that a number of Europeans began talking about Europe as a valid mission field. Before that, they were all offended. Missionaries are the people we send to Africa. Those are the people we send to India. Those are the people we send to South America. Not here. We're a Christian nation. We're a Christian continent. Well, obviously the news, it's not news to any of you, it's no longer Christian. And again, if it ever was, okay? So I want to kind of deal with that theme today, but I think the key to even beginning to think about the missional nature of the church is to realize this basic idea. We are in a culture that is not really Christian at all. There may be Christian influences there, but it's not Christian. We need to see ourselves as resident aliens. I think that's a term that Stanley Hauerwas was the one that first popularized that. But it really comes out of 1 Peter chapter 2. That we're to live here as strangers and aliens within this world. And I want to explore that a little bit. Before I get there, let me talk about the term missional. The term missional is used by all kinds of different people in different ways. And in one sense, I really don't care to try to convince you of any particular definition of missional. I don't want to fight that battle. But what I want to do is at least give you a definition as to how we tend to use that term missional, and then I'll make my remarks in relation to that. A missional church, from our perspective, is a church that's not only evangelistic, or that not only has programs for evangelism or ways to reach out to the community, but it's actually a church that takes a particular posture to the community in which it exists, that surrounds it. Let me try to help that. A missional church is one that is in the community, of the community, and for the community. In it, in the sense that the church is physically located in that community. It's composed of people from that society, all the different kinds of people that are within that area, and it's of the community in the sense that it's reflecting the culture of that community. It is interacting with the way in which that community thinks, the cultural narratives within that community. And it's for the community in the sense that that church actually not only preaches the gospel, but is actually serving to care for that community, to improve that community. A number of years ago, there was a situation in which Redeemer Presbyterian Church was going to plant its first church in New York City. And they determined that they would plant it in Greenwich Village. And I don't know how much you know about Greenwich Village, but it used to be an intellectual center within New York City. It was where the poets and the philosophers and the musicians, so if you remember Bob Dylan and, you know, those kinds of people, they were all part of the village. They issued out of the village. It's no longer really that. In fact, it's at this point in time, it's about the most expensive place in New York City to live. So really it's inhabited by, for the most part, 65 and over male homosexuals, cultural elites that are again above 60, and extremely wealthy architects. That's who lives there. It's an incredibly resistant community to the gospel. But Redeemer decided that was the next most strategic place to plant a church in the city. So they went through a very unscientific process, and they looked around their staff, and they said, we need to plant a church in the village. Who wants to plant a church in the village? And one of the guys says, I do. And he was actually a very smart guy, you know, very, very well equipped in many ways. And so Scott decided that he was going to plant a church in the village. Then they went to the congregation of Redeemer. They said, we're going to plant a new church in the village. Who wants to go with Scott and plant a church in the village? So about 120 or 130, 20-somethings, you know, 24, 23, 27, all decided that they wanted to go with Scott to help plant that church in the village. That church no longer exists. It was actually very successful at first. It was almost like that seed that falls among the rocky soil. It sprouts up, you know, and then in a very short time, it's no longer there. We actually now use that church as an illustration of many of the mistakes that you can actually make in church planting. Nothing wrong with Scott, nothing wrong with the folks, you know, that went there. But here there were a number of problems. One is the church was underfinanced. So there was no way that Scott could live in the village. He had to live outside. So none of the normal incarnational relationships that normally you would develop when you live and you're in that community, none of those were taking place. There was no such thing as a peripatetic ministry, mm-hmm. a walking around yeah. ministry where you'd know people. That was one mistake.
Fiber.
Second mistake, that core group, 120, 130 young people, not one of them could live in the village. When a very small apartment costs $5,000 a month to rent, you're not going to see a young, you know, person that's making $25,000 a year in New York City be able to live there. Now, the village was a cool place to hang out in, so they would come in to the clubs and the bars and the cafes, the restaurants and all those kinds of things, but they weren't in the community. They weren't in the community. So what happened was, because they weren't in the community, they actually were never of the community. So their sensibilities as they created worship were actually reflecting their own values, not the values or the cultural narratives of the village. So they created a worship style, program, or whatever, that for me, a baby boomer, was some of the best worship I ever experienced my entire life. It was incredible, but it wasn't appropriate for the village. And third, because they were neither in the community or really of the community, they actually couldn't be for the community. They didn't understand the community. They really didn't know what the needs were in the community. So even though they created some good ministries to homeless and some of those kinds of things, none of it resonated in the community. 7 years, one person comes to Christ from the village. Lots of other people came to Christ, but none from the village. I think, now, even though it was a good church for a long time, it actually grew to be a church about 500 before it began to gradually decline. But because they never reached that community, it was only as other churches were planted in the city, you know, a lot of the young people that were there would go to the church that was close to them. And it was very similar to that church that was created. But because it was it was in the community only in one sense, it wasn't of the community, it really wasn't for the community, it ceased to have a missional impact on that community. And that's a mistake. In one sense, I want to say it was a tragedy. Even though the church was orthodox, even though the church was excellent in so many of the things, the choices it made, they weren't appropriate for the community. So I think all three of those things are needed to be in, of, and for, in order for a church to be effective in the place in which it exists. Now let me jump. In Jeremiah 29, if you have a Bible, feel free to turn there. I'm going to read a portion of that. And this may be a counterintuitive passage to turn to talk about this issue. But I think in Jeremiah 29, we have an illustration, or maybe I'll put it this way. I think we have clues that can help us today to figure out how to live in a community in a missional relationship. Now, I'm sure you remember the basic backdrop here, but Judah has been taken into captivity into Babylon. And they're there, there's false prophets basically saying, the Lord's going to bring you right back. Don't worry, okay? Don't unpack your bags. You'll be coming back before you know it. And the Lord sends a letter through the prophet Jeremiah to the people living there, giving them instructions about how they're to live there. By the way, let me just reflect. There was a video the first night, I think it was by Open Doors, and there was a comment made within that video that I found myself kind of reacting negatively to. The question I think came was, would you live any differently if you knew that Jesus was going to come back this week? You know, and I think the assumed answer was, we should not live any differently if Jesus is going to come back this week versus him coming back 100 years from now. I want to take issue with that idea. I actually think that that's a wrong way to think. There's, in a certain way, we should live in a conscious awareness of the imminent return of Christ. He really could come back at any time. So there should be a type of urgency connected to what we do. But be careful with that idea, because it's likely that he may not come back within our generation. He may not come back in 100 years. It may be 1,000 years. God forbid. I hope he comes back before that. But indeed, the Lord may delay his coming. So how should we live now, given that we don't know when he'll return? Well, I think we get some clues to that in Jeremiah 29. So I'm just going to read the letter. So this is Jeremiah 29, verse 4. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Do not let those prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Do not listen to the dreams you encourage them to have. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, when 70 years are completed, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place, back to Jerusalem. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. Now the letter actually goes on. But let me talk from that passage just a moment in relation to this kind of missional church idea. I think the ideas in this passage can be summarized in kind of three sets of statements, if you will. The first is this: you're not coming back to Jerusalem soon. So therefore, I want you to live there fully. In fact, from another passage in Ezekiel, we know that the Israelites were actually living outside of Babylon. It says they were living along the banks of the Kabar or the Chebar River. And I think in essence, the implication is here, I want you to move in. Don't remain separate outside the city, you know, as a, some sort of a monastic group. But I want you to move in the city. I want you to settle in. I want you to unpack your bags. I want you to buy houses, build houses. I want you to plant gardens. I want you to do business in the city. I want you to engage in that city, even though it was one of the most corrupt and powerful cities on the face of the globe at that point in time. You're not coming back soon. I want you to live there fully, participate fully in the life of that city. The second thing he says is essentially this, and I think that this may have come as a shock to them, or at least I think it was a counterintuitive statement. Here's what he says, basically. At least we use this term. I want you to love that city. Yeah, really? The city of the Babylonians? The city of the conquerors? The city of the pagans? This corrupt and vile place that is raised up against the glory of God? Yes. I want you to love that city. Here's the words he actually uses are these. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city. Now listen, to which I have carried you. I've put you here. I've brought you here. This wasn't a result of the power of the Babylonians. Listen, I let this happen, and it was because they were punishing. He was disciplining Israel because they had turned away from him. So I've carried you here. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to seek the peace and prosperity of this place. I want you to engage in this city, to care about this city, all aspects of the city. Now, the interesting piece of that is that as you do that, it will prosper. And as it prospers, you will prosper too. So there's kind of a side benefit. It's to our benefit when we engage in a place. He wants us literally to love the city. I'll say something more about that in just a minute. But then the third piece, and this comes after when you come back to, I know that the plans I have for you. I love that verse, by the way. It's one of my favorite passages in all of Scripture. This whole idea that no matter what happens, and John's been talking about suffering and that kind of thing, but I know the plans I have for you. They're not for destruction. I literally hold you in my hand. You can trust me. I'll bring you back. But anyways, in that section, essentially what we hear is don't assimilate. I want you in the city. I want you engaged in the city, but I don't want you to be absorbed by that city. I don't want you to be taken over. I don't want you to lose your faith because you're still my people. So resist being compromised by the culture. I know the plans I have for you. You're still my people. Now, in this passage, I know that the element of witness is not prominent. I'll end up making a comment about that later on. But I think in this, we have a picture of what it means for believers, the people of God, to live in a foreign land, to live in a culture that really is not ours and that will never be ours. I hear a lot of people talk about transformation of cities, transformation of culture, you know, these kinds of things, and I actually don't resonate with that language at all. I think it's actually unhelpful language for us to use as Christians. In fact, I'm pretty much committed to the idea that I think the church is always going to be a remnant. We are never going to be dominant. And even in, you know, you heard me say this a couple times as I was introducing, in one sense, even though there was this thing called Christendom, where theoretically all of Europe was Christian, right? Everybody was baptized. I mean, that was part of being a citizen. First you were part of the Church of Rome, but then later you were Lutheran, or you were Reformed, or you were Church of England, or something else. But everyone was deemed to be Christian. Even at the height of Christendom, my guess, and as you look back at many of the greats of our faith, many of their analysis were that less than 30% of the population were real believers in Christ. In fact, it was probably far less than that. Calvin in Geneva, which was constituted a Christian city where you were forced to subscribe to Christ, even he said it would be fortunate if there were 1 out of 100 that were real devout believers in Christ in Geneva. 1%. You know, that's the reality. So I don't think we should be talking in terms of transformation, because in one sense, this is not our home. Yes, we're living here. I know a number of you are cross-cultural missionaries, so you kind of feel this. This is not your home, and yet you are called to be committed to this place and to the people here. You're called to bring the evidence of the gospel to bear on this culture and on the people living in this culture. I think that's the picture that we have in here. We need to live in the world as resident aliens and yet not be compromised. We are not merely tourists. We're supposed to dig in. We're actually supposed to care about the communities in which we need to live. We need to live in this world as if the Lord will not return for 100 years or even longer. And I think there's all kinds of implications to that. Secondly, and I think this is kind of the most radical of the instructions that he gives here, we are to seek the peace and prosperity of that city, which I was interpreting as a call to love that city. When we talk about loving a city, we're usually not talking about generating affection for a place. Although it's ironic, as you begin to love a city, which I think means demonstrating the love of God to the people of that place, as you begin to move out and do what is right, seeking justice, seeking to alleviate, you know, the injustice in society, as you try to meet the needs of the poor, as you try to communicate the gospel to the people living there, it's an interesting thing, but you actually begin to actually feel affection for the place. This may sound weird to some of you, but I love New York City. But it is a raucous, difficult, arrogant place. You think Donald Trump is an anomaly? Not so. He's a New Yorker, okay, unfortunately, okay? There's too many of us like Donald Trump in New York City. It's hard to love people like that. And yet when you begin to try to demonstrate the love of God to a place like New York, you actually begin to fall in love with it. And many New Yorkers feel, why would I want to be anywhere else in the world? I think one of the keys to actually making a real difference in the place in which you live is for you to really feel like, I would never want to be any other place. And that may be a difficult place, like Lagos. I was talking about Lagos a little bit yesterday in my talk. That's a difficult place to live. And yet you can fall in love, you know, with a city as you begin to demonstrate the love of God to that city. I believe that we are to be committed to the places that God has put us and realize that God has put us there. But not out of some sort of eschatological expectation that the place is going to be somehow heaven on you know, this side of an eternal state, but rather out of response to the grace of God that he has poured out in our lives. In fact, in one sense, I believe that the motivation for anything and everything that we do in the Christian life it ought to be gratitude. Gratitude which gives rise to love. The more we realize how much God has done for us in Christ, the more we actually respond, okay, God, what do you want me to do? And what I think we have in the scriptures, and I think it says it's in a number of places, but it really comes from not this eschatological expectation, but rather from the second great command. What's the first? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy strength, thy might. You know it, you probably know it better than I can. I can quote it when I'm up front. What's the second? Jesus adds it really quickly. Love your neighbor as yourself. What is it that God wants us to do? Let me be careful here. Be careful. It's not so much evangelize. He wants us to love. He wants to move out into love. Now, what comes along is one of the greatest things you can do for anybody at any point in their lives is to introduce them to the person that can actually change their entire lives. That's where evangelism comes in. But it's not evangelism out of duty. It's actually evangelism that comes out of love. And really, it's an evangelism that comes out of love that has been inspired by gratitude. We're given two really quick pictures of the church in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4. You remember that picture? Surely you do. But you see this kind of natural, organic evangelism taking place. In essence, people have had this unbelievable experience of coming to know Christ. And their natural reaction is to bring everybody they know. You got to come. You got to see this. And then they're sharing with one another. They're sharing with everybody around. Their experience is in fellowship that's crazy good. If you want a missional church in Italy, is create a church that has such intense community that where you guys really love each other and where you're really trying to reach out in love to the community. That will be infectious. They will then be willing to hear the gospel. They open their hearts to the gospel. So I believe we all should be committed to the places in which we live. And I think what that means is that we are to care about justice in a place. We are to care about alleviating the needs of the oppressed. We're supposed to care about the poor and needy. But we're also supposed to care about education. We're supposed to care about sewers. Does that sound crazy? Parks. jobs, the economy, the political atmosphere. I mean, we're actually called to care about all those kinds of things, because all of that is part of is a derivative of love your neighbor as yourself. I'm often in Johannesburg, South Africa. It's one of the most violent cities in the entire world. It's really an interesting place to be in a number of ways. It's a beautiful city, and the people are amazing. However, you go outside your door and you need to fear for your life. Almost every door has several locks on it, and there's several locked doors or gates until you can get out to the street. But in most parts of Johannesburg, a woman cannot walk through a neighborhood without fear that she'll be picked up and raped and often murdered. And I can tell you a bunch of stories of that happening. One of the guys that does missionary university work down there for campus outreach, their home has been broken into more than 160 times, a stealing thing. But there's an oppressive feeling in that environment, because you're always looking around. You pull up to a stoplight. You got to make sure that no one pulls up too close behind you, or that you're not too close to one in front of you. Because if you get pinned in, then what happens is they'll jack your car. They'll come up, break your window, and hold you up at gunpoint. So you got to be able to pull away. I mean, it's crazy things. But that oppressive environment literally weighs people down. It crushes them. So one of the greatest things a Christian should do is increase police protection. Make sure your government isn't corrupt, so that people can have freedom. Where there's law and where there's justice, there's freedom that comes. We need to care about all those kinds of things. So even, you know, one of the derivatives of this, I think we need to care about culture change. We need to literally try to influence the culture, not take it over, but actually influence it, so that it actually provides a place where children can grow up in freedom and safety, and where we can raise our families, where we can get ahead in life. So a missional church is one that not only engages evangelistically, and I don't want to discount that, but it also helps their people to live in a world as resident aliens. They help them figure that figure out what that really means. But let me complete the thought. I don't want to discount evangelism, okay? Because actually the reality is that a church is really not missional unless it is calling people into a saving relationship with Christ. The gospel must be present. I don't think it's appropriate to do mercy ministry and not explain why you're doing it. As I look through the New Testament, although Jesus does any number of acts of mercy for people, he is always explaining why he's doing it. He's calling people to worship his Father. He's calling people into that relationship. Many of the churches that are being planted today, particularly in North America, but also now throughout much of Northern and Western Europe, they call themselves missional churches. And oftentimes they are they're adopting a form that is attractive, that might even be called cool. So they get a kicking band, they wear the earring in the ear, they preach from the laptop, you know, that kind of thing. And they're generating, you know, a real inviting atmosphere. But one of the things I see that's often lacking is the gospel seems hidden or blurred or whatever. So this is a weird question to ask, I suppose. But I think it gets to the heart of the issue. And I think John was talking about it at the end of his discussion there. But do you actually believe that the gospel can change people's lives? I would submit that many of us actually don't. We believe and yet we don't believe. So we want to do all the kinds of things to kind of get people involved and that kind of thing, but oftentimes we actually don't get to the point at which we're literally confronting people with Jesus himself. I think we need to be careful as churches that message doesn't get blurred. Now, I suspect many churches in Italy actually err on the other side. They're beating the drum for Jesus Christ died for your sins, and they're actually not relating to the cultural narrative. So there's probably a need to balance it on the other side. But don't hear us as saying that the gospel isn't important or that evangelism actually isn't important. But evangelism is often a derivative of community these days, rather than so much confronting people with a very short explanation of the gospel. So what does that mean for churches today, particularly in Europe and I guess particularly in Italy? It means at least, I think, three major things. We need to realize that the culture that surrounds us is no longer Christian. Beat that dead horse a little bit, but let me come back to it. For the last 300 or 400 years, and even in recent times, much of the starting of new churches, the planting of new churches, has essentially been what we call confessional church planting. I don't know if you know what I mean by that. But in essence, we have the Church of Rome, and they lose the gospel. They get off course. So the reformers, their whole intent is to recover the gospel. And actually, they never meant to leave the Church of Rome, the Catholic Church. I hate to use that term because I don't think that church is Catholic. I think it's a Roman church. But anyways, they never meant to leave that church. They never meant to create a schism or schism, however you guys pronounce that word. Their attempt was to recover the gospel and return or reform the church so that it would continue to be New Testament-like. But they were thrown out. That's an easy way to put it. Sometimes they lost their lives and those kinds of things. But in essence, they ended up creating new denominations: Lutheran, Reformed, eventually Baptist, Anabaptist, Methodist, Church of England. There's a number of different forms of those things. But what happened is, as any number of those Protestant denominations lost focus on the gospel or diverged from orthodoxy, a new form of the church was created that was more doctrinally pure. I mean, essentially, that was the Anabaptist intent, was they wanted to create a pure, devout Christian community, because they were looking at all these people that were baptized. They said, that's wrong, so we're going to actually use immersion now and only baptize adults. But their intent was they wanted to create a devout community. That was about a confession. But all of those movements, even up to the modern day, all of those were predicated on the notion that there were shared assumptions in the culture, and all we needed to do was create a better form of the church. And I'm not speaking dismissively about that. But we need to create a better church, and if we do, that will actually do the job. Recent times, there's been a passing fad, I think that's really what it is, called postmodernism. Let me back up. In essence, confessional church planting was taking place, and then modernism happens, end of the 18th century. And essentially, for the 19th century and most of the 20th, it slowly guts the church. It pulls a lot of the churches away from orthodoxy, causes them to question the authority of the scripture, causes them to abandon the primary tenets of the gospel, and those churches become really no churches at all. And so then postmodernism comes along, and for many people, they thought this was the great hope, because postmodernism, in one sense, opened the door to spirituality. And so we saw a whole rush of church over the last 20 years that were, in essence, creating a new form of the church. And oftentimes, they were emphasizing authenticity of relationships. They were recovering historic forms of the church. They wanted a sense of the mystical. They want a sense of connection to ancient. But the problem with many of those postmodern forms, although some of them were orthodox, many of them weren't. And actually, they began to imbibe pretty errant doctrine. So we saw a lot of those churches kind of come and go. They're no longer there. I want to suggest that where you are, where we are, in Europe at this point, is it's not only post-Christendom. It's not only post-modern, but in one sense, it's popomo, okay? It's post-postmodernism, which, you know what that is? That's post-Christian, or if you will, neo-pagan. There's a sense in which the world today in Europe is more like what it was in the first century than any other intervening century. We've gone back to the time in most places, in many places in Europe, where Christianity is no longer known. Two guys walk into Berlin. This is not a joke. Two guys walk into Berlin, and they're going into what used to be East Berlin in an area called Prince Lauerberg. And as they began to talk to people, get to know people there, and that sort of thing, a number of people said, well, what are you doing here? Well, we're here to start a church. A church? They really didn't have much of a definition of that. There was a church building in that community, by the way. There was no church there at all. And then they described themselves as pastors. There was no definition for pastor. Most people there had never, ever met a Christian, let alone somebody that was a pastor. So I think they thought in terms of taking care of sheep or something, pasture. But when they finally would have to say, well, it's kind of like a priest. Okay, we got that kind of thing. But they were coming into a culture that really had no knowledge anymore of Christ and the gospel. You mention Abraham, they're likely to think it was Abraham Lincoln. You know, a lot of, you make reference to the stories, they wouldn't know Daniel in the lion's den. Doesn't make any sense to them. What is the cross about? Don't really understand. There's these weird statues in places with some guy bleeding all over the place. No reference as to what that really means. I want to suggest that that's where Europe is or is becoming. And if that's the case, I think we've got, in one sense, to go back. We've got to go back and begin interacting with the culture in the same way the Apostle Paul did. So when he comes to Athens, Acts chapter 17, you remember this whole thing. He can't merely argue from the scriptures. By the way, he had just done this in Philippi. He'd gone out to the river, you know, where the women are meeting and the God-fearers are meeting. And basically what he does out there is he's arguing from the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, to Christ. Now he's in Athens. They don't have any regard for the Bible at all. So it'd be worthless for him to say, the Bible says. In fact, I want to suggest that that statement has less and less value in Europe as well. Not too many people have very high regard for the Bible, although eventually I think we have to drive them back to the Word. But what Paul does is he enters into their cultural narrative and he argues from the unknown God to here's the God that really is. And Jesus is that God. We've got to begin doing those kinds of things. We've got to live and act as if people don't understand Christianity, as if they don't understand or share our assumptions. Europe has changed, and there's no longer any default to go to church in Europe any more than there was in Babylon to go to a Jewish synagogue. By the way, one more aside. I'm probably going a little bit long. But we think, most historians now think, that the synagogue idea was created during the captivity in Babylon. What was the device that they invented in order to keep themselves pure, in order to keep themselves believing? Well, they created synagogues, which really just means a gathering together, okay? Which is essentially what the church means too. You know, ecclesia is to be called out or to be called together. That's what churches are. They're gatherings of believers. But we actually, the church today, actually copied the synagogue. That's what we've done. And this was the instrument that God used to call people into a saving relationship to Christ. But can you imagine, you create a Jewish synagogue in pagan Babylon? How many Babylonians would want to come to synagogue? Hey, we're going to synagogue this week. We got a kicking band. Yeah, I think you'd really love it. I don't understand Judaism. You know, this is a religion I don't even like. You guys are slaves. Are you kidding me? Well, that's much like what it's like in Europe today. You know, when you ask people to go to church, they would say, many people would say, why? If they ever do come, oddly enough, we've discovered this over the last 10 years or so, when somebody does come and they actually like it, there's never a thought that they would come back the next week. Why would I go back again? I mean, I did that once. You know, that's enough. Because there's not an understanding of what church is all about or Christ is all about. We've got to take a different posture to our culture. There's a strong anti-Christian mood in Europe these days. I was talking to a guy that works, I think he's associated with the European Evangelical Alliance, but he works up in Brussels and he's, in effect, the Christian ambassador to the EU. And Christel Nyambi is his name. He's a Cameroonian guy, unbelievably bright, really sharp guy. But he's often invited to go and speak to, you know, the various governmental agencies in various countries. But he was up in Sweden. They asked him to come up. And he was speaking in favor of Christianity. Now, that may sound like a strange thing. But where Sweden is, this is what Christel was telling me, is that where Sweden is at this point is that it used to be that the church was regarded as good. And they were believing. It was a Lutheran nation. It was a fairly Christian nation. Then, in the mid-20th century, it began to be something that was tolerated. The churches do good things. They take care of the poor. They take care of the elderly. They provide some good social benefits. But you know what the situation now is in Sweden? The church is seen as the enemy. It's the heart of racism. It's a heart of social disunity. They're against the homosexuals. They're against this. They're against that. That's how the church is conceived, even though I don't think that's really the case at all. But the church is actually seen as a negative. One of the other videos was talking about North Korea, where the church is the enemy of the state. That's what it's like in Sweden now. That's how they regard. It's not quite as bad as that crazy dictator in North Korea, but it is similar to that. That's how the church regards. It's not regarded as a good thing. It's actually regarded as a negative within society. And that's what's happening quickly in the United States. I've been shocked in 3 years how things have changed in the United States. So if you say that you believe that homosexuality is an aberrant lifestyle, that it's not an acceptable behavior, as regarded as hate speech, and now you can be taken to court and sued. Even churches, as they begin to say those things, you know, that's what's going to be happening. The culture has changed. I need to try to conclude. So let me finish kind of my last two points. So what do we need to do? First is this. I think we need to rethink our churches. We need to design our churches so that what we do is sensible to outsiders. So we need to do things like avoiding tribal language, unnecessary evangelical pious jargon that people won't understand. We need to be careful of we-they language. We need to be careful of assuming that people understand, you know, what we're talking about when oftentimes they don't. So being careful in our communication. A missional church avoids talking as if non-Christians aren't there. One of the things we actually talk a lot about is that as you preach or as you're giving announcements or as you're praying or any of those kinds of things, it'd be helpful to imagine that every kind of person in your community is actually sitting in front of you. Radical feminist, you know, angry male homosexual, you know, loving lesbian, you know, atheistic Jewish person, you know, very skeptical, arrogant Wall Street, you know, tycoon type thing. If you imagined all the people in your community sitting in front of you, and so they were literally parsing every word, you know, think it through, you would speak differently. You would talk differently. You would explain things differently. And it would become more understandable to the community that you're living in. Secondly, we need to understand and sympathize with the culture narratives. I talked about this a little bit in the workshop yesterday, so I won't say much about that. But we need to understand what is driving the hearts and lives of our people and then figure out how the gospel answers the very things that they have. Then I think third, we need to theologically train people not only to pray, to read their Bible, and to somehow bear witness to the community, but we actually need to prepare them for the other 6 days of the week. What does it mean to be a journalist and to be a Christian? There was a guy one time that came up to, Tim Keller had been talking about this issue, this is many years ago, but a guy came up to Tim after this message, and Tim was saying you need to actually do your work, the gospel should influence the work you do. And so when he came up to Tim, and he said, Tim, I want to understand what that means. I don't understand what it means. You know, what does it mean for the gospel to apply to what I do? And Tim said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, you know, I'm an editor for the money investing section of the Wall Street Journal. And Tim said, yeah, I know what your job is. Okay, I know that you're an editor, and that's a pretty highly placed guy in New York City. But I want to know, what do you actually do? He said, oh, well, that's a different issue. He said, basically what I do is I gather with the other 7 editors of the Wall Street Journal every morning. And by the way, the same thing happens with the New York Times, the Le Monde in Paris, you know, the London Times, the San Francisco Observer, you know, Washington Post. You mentioned a number of the leading papers in the world. And what we do is we determine what the world will talk about that day. Woo. How should the gospel impact that? Because the reality is, whatever the world is talking about, they'll actually do something about. Whatever is ignored, it's swept under the carpet, doesn't get any attention. So how should the gospel impact? You know what Tim said to him? His answer was, I don't know. He said, Tim, and Tim's response was, I don't know enough about journalism to actually help, you know, give you, you know, a number of different answers. But here's what I do know. I know the Bible. I know the realm of theology. And what would be really interesting is to get maybe 4 or 5 journalists together and you guys begin talking about the issues that you face. I'd be glad to speak into that, but because I don't know your world, I can't really just tell you, but I'd be willing to be involved in a process. We need to figure out how we can help people live and work intelligently out of a gospel orientation. What does it mean? And it's not about necessarily having a Bible on your desk so that somebody else notices that you're Christian, so you have an opportunity to, you know, to try to share the gospel with them. Although that's good too, if you can. That often doesn't work in New York, okay? Or it doesn't work in a lot of the big cities. And the third, or the fourth issue there is that we need to create a Christian community, or the type of Christian community, that is truly countercultural. That is, particularly in relation to sex, money, and power. We need to live lives that are qualitatively different in the whole sexual realm. Secondly, we need to be radically generous with our money and exercise stewardship in relation to giving money to those things that will really matter, and not hoarding it, holding on to it, just being content to be more and more wealthy. And third, we need to be able to use our power not for self-aggrandizement, but rather for the sake of addressing the needs of the injustice within our society, changing our culture, those kinds of things. And much more could be said about that. The last thing I'll say here is that the other aspect is that we need to demonstrate God's love to the community around us. If we're going to be in a missional posture, we've got to actually try to figure out how we can demonstrate the love of God to the community around us. And there's two different reasons for this, and then I'll be done. A number of years ago, I'd planted a church in a little community just outside of New York, very wealthy community, extremely wealthy community. But there was a pocket of people living right in the heart of the little hamlet that were all the servants of all these wealthy people living on these huge estates. They were the gardeners, they were the maids, you know, they were the nannies and all this kind of stuff. And many of them were being taken advantage of slumlords. So there was often, you know, 20 people living in a two-bedroom apartment. A lot of people were from El Salvador. They were illegal, immigrants, that sort of thing. But so they were taken advantage of, and many of them didn't have enough food to eat. They literally were starving. In the midst of wealth, here they were starving. And one of the guys that had come to Christ through our ministry knew that those people were there. I didn't know they were there. And he came and he suggested that we create some sort of a feeding ministry. There was a government program that would hand out cheese and rice and flour, you know, some of those staples, but not fresh milk, vegetables, you know, meat, you know, those kinds of things. And so I said, listen, Howard, if you want to try to create that, I will be completely supportive of it. So this little church, we began, you know, distributing food. I think it was each week or maybe it was 1 week a month. I don't recall right now. But it started that way. And all we were doing was really giving out food. And we weren't trying to witness to them as they came, although they knew it was a church. But it was literally, we were trying to meet their needs. Now, I think we did put a tract in every bag. But we were simply trying to meet their needs. The irony of that thing was kind of twofold. One was, five of the men that were connected to women in our church that were believers, who began helping that ministry, came to Christ in 6 months. Because they were experiencing such joy as they were helping people in need, and they were rubbing shoulder with other real believers, that they began coming to church, they began coming under the hearing of the gospel, and lo and behold, they came to Christ. Many of the people that received the food were actually coming to Christ as well. But this one story I think is really illustrative. So this church, we had bought an old Methodist church building. It was down at the bottom of a hill. And up on the top of the hill was St. Dominic's, the big Roman Catholic church in the area. And it was 10,000 members or some huge number of people. There was a very wealthy guy in that church. Most of the people were wealthy, by the name of Sabaro. Okay, he was a good Italian guy, good Italian Catholic. He's at a party, a cocktail party, talking to a friend of his, and one of our elders happens to be standing there with his back to these two guys that are talking. And Sabaro speaks to this other guy, and he says, have you guys, do you know that little church that's at the bottom of the hill? And the guy says, yeah, I know. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but yeah, I know the church. And he said, have you heard what they're doing? He said, no, what are they doing? He said, do you realize that they are feeding people that have been starving in our own community? They're giving away food? He said, no. I didn't know that. And so here's Sabaro. Now, he was a member of that church. Here's what he says. If I was ever to go back to church again, I'd go to that church. And the guy said, why would you go to that church? Because that's what a church is actually supposed to do, care about people. Now that story is relevant because, in essence, as we attend to the needs of people, as we reach out in love to people, we actually create an apologetic for the gospel, because what we're doing is giving witness to what we're actually saying. Now, I don't think that we can ever not say, you know, but in West Africa, there's a saying that I discovered a number of years ago, an empty stomach has no ears. You probably know that one, right? But when somebody's starving, you've got to take care of their physical need first. Jesus did it all the time, and then he ministers to the gospel then. If we're going to be in a missional relationship to our culture, we've got to be in, of, and for that culture. We've actually got to be deeply engaged. We've got to be demonstrating the love of God to that community, and we need to be giving voice to the gospel that can literally change their lives. Thank you. Thank you.